You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM and KBOO.FM online.
High-speed rail has been safely, efficiently, and affordably transporting people around the world for nearly 60 years now. But until recently, it's never been able to move forward in America. High-speed rail systems are now underway in California and in Texas. And with a new progressive administration in Washington, D.C., is it time for bullet trains in America? My guest today, Brad Perkins, has been working to save the dream of high-speed rail on the tracks in the Pacific Northwest. I'm Trevor Collins, and this is Times Like Now. Hello, Brad Perkins. Thank you for joining me today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
So you've been involved with high-speed rail out of Portland, Oregon, working on this from your side of things for almost 15 years. Is that about right?
Yeah.
Now,
yeah, that's right.
Explain to me and to everyone the definition, what makes high-speed rail a high-speed rail?
Well, first of all, I'm probably best just to talk about the Federal Highway Administration, what their interpretation of high-speed rail is here in America. And essentially, it's any train that goes 110 miles per hour or greater. And right now, the maximum that any train can go on the system that's run by the freight companies, there are about five of them, is 79 miles an hour. So there's a big difference between the two.
Okay. That clarifies things. Now, high-speed rail has been a wonderful way of transportation around the world for 60 years or more. There's Europe, all over Europe, and Belgium and France and Italy and Spain. Spain just has announced a new line going from Madrid to Barcelona, I read about. Why the lack of high-speed rail in the United States?
That's a good question. A lot of people have different answers for that, but mine basically is that the oil companies and the car companies have dominated our lives ever since I was born, which was close to 70 years ago. We were born with it, and we have stuck with it, and a lot of people feel very comfortable with it, even to this day. But if you calculate the number of hours sitting on the freeway waiting to get through the congestion, people are starting to take a different approach and think that there's maybe a better way of getting around that's much faster, reliable, and frequent, especially reliable, so that they can get to their son's or daughter's ball game in time. And all that they have to deal with then would be the last mile or a couple miles to their destination from the stop that we hope to create with our system, which will not just be for inner city, but also for commuters and lightweight freight.
So some of the history of the Pacific Northwest Rail Corridor, explain to me, this is running from Vancouver, British Columbia, to approximately Eugene,
that's
Oregon,
right?
Is that designated? That's the designated Pacific Northwest Rail Corridor. This was designated by the Fed government
in the 90s. It's a 460-mile corridor that they felt was within the top 10 corridors throughout the United States. And recently, the United States High Speed Rail Association has rated our corridor in the Northwest to be number 4 on the priority list.
Okay, so the train is possibly coming out of the station very nice and slowly, but this has been going on for decades now. There have been surveys and environmental impact surveys and for decades, and I'm guessing it's just millions of dollars have been spent to study this concept, but do you think that's just shuffling it under the rug?
Well, let's be clear. There haven't been surveys, so to speak. I think of, getting civil engineer out there and start laying out the corridor, nor have there been very many real surveys of people as to interest in this type of system. We have done a number of studies ourselves. Well, two things are going on, okay? First, you've got the state of Washington that has recently, in the last 5 years, done about three studies totaling about $2.6 million. They have to do with feasibility and governance, how it's going to happen through the government, basically. And then our approach is more of a private-public approach that will be both financed by the public, but in the majority sense by private interests. And we've done, for the past 15 years, our corridor analysis with our engineers, and also done feasibility studies, and also been registered with the Federal Rail Administration as a corridor with a serious approach to where it should be. Right now, we are currently working with a company in Frederick, Maryland, that is specialist in transportation systems and economics, and I've hired them before. But the recent study that's going on right now is our environmental impact statement study. And what that will entail, since you have not heard of us or what's going on at this point, you will be soon, because we have to go out to 17 different communities in the corridor between Wilsonville and Everett, Washington, to get the feedback from the people and see what they think.
Now, how is that going to be done? Will that be promoted or advertised, or how is that going to get around, like mailing, or how are people going to be hearing this?
Various different ways. We will be getting it out in the newspapers, radios, and talking about this and inviting people to participate in the latest form of community get-togethers via Zoom or whatever. We hope by the time that the end of summer comes around, we'll be pretty close to finishing this. We have been delayed since this pandemic, so we anticipate that we'll get some pretty good response from the people. We already have already, just talking about it and talking to various officials about it. There's not much negative feedback that we're getting, because the way in which we're proposing it is not going to be coming from so much the public trough. Okay. Our transportation secretary was great the other day talking about how high-speed rail not only should happen in America, but America should lead in high-speed rail development in the world. Pete Buttigieg did a great job in introducing this as one of the first priorities. And it makes a lot of sense, because one thing great about this type of system, we can cut the time getting to where you need to go, usually by a third, and cost less in its development than a one lane extra on a freeway would cost. And also, it's amazing as what it does for economic development at the station areas, which a freeway, a new lane on a freeway won't do.
Sure. You mentioned the cost. What is the average rider, the cost to an average rider, let's say in a European euro, for a ride? Do you have any of that off the top of your head? How affordable is it for somebody of low income to go from here to there? Or what do you know? Can you quote me any of that?
Well, when my wife and I went from Nice to Paris, which, it was about 4.5 hours and hundreds of miles, it was $60 a person. That's phenomenal. And we will be looking at this in such a way that it'll have different categories of ticket prices based on age and income, basically. That let's say a student or a child under 12 or a person over 65 will be charged accordingly. We are not that far along, but this is the framework that we are working in.
Yeah, this is similar to, let's say, the San Francisco Bay and the Bay Area Rapid Transit, BART, as it's called. That is, there's senior citizen prices and student prices, and yeah, that's an efficient way for middle class or poor, or you know, to get around the Bay Area. And that program has grown and expanded a lot over the years. One of my favorite trips is jumping on the BART and, you know, bouncing around the Bay Area so freely and easily and conveniently. Mm-hmm. Your program is a isolated, or you are your own thing. I know that there is a group in Seattle that are looking at Vancouver, BC to Seattle. Are you in communication with them at all?
That's called the Cascada Innovation Corridor Group, headed up by former Governor Christine Brigore. Yeah, I've been up there at conferences. I've participated. And it's great. They're, you know, they got the right idea, because they're combining government with the higher ed institutions up and down the corridor, as well as Microsoft and other industries that would benefit by the transport of people very quickly and frequently and reliably between their destinations. Their biggest benefit would be having people from Vancouver, BC come into Seattle and work and then go home in the evening, or, you know, have a situation where you just work a couple days a week and down in Seattle and spend most of their time back home and doing their work. So there's a big advantage there because of the income differences between the two regions.
Okay. So that program is going forward. Are they making progress, or what's the latest with that? I mean, because that may benefit you in the Portland and Oregon to, you know, in your corridor. Are they moving forward?
Well, here's what's interesting. we're spearheading this much faster than they are. As you know, government takes forever to get things done and costs twice as much that it would take for private industry. We're proving that. We're doing this in a way in which we spend our time. I'm a real estate broker, okay? This is not my full-time effort here. But I have been working on it for 15 years, and my engineer, who has been working on this the same amount of time, is going full-time on it.
What are some of his qualifications? Who is your engineer?
Yeah, Rudy is a retired Swiss engineer. He worked for Custodis, which was an engineering and repair and development company related to smokestacks throughout the United States. And from that experience, he was head troubleshooter, designer, and rebuilder of these towering smokestacks for industry. Rudy has always had a mind for engineering, and I haven't. My mind is mostly in design and real estate development opportunities. So we have been a good pairing of skills. And from that, we can analyze this whole court. I've lived here all my life, basically, and Rudy has been here since the early 60s. And he came here with that notion in mind, that he wanted to use his skills to make America greater. And that basically is where I am at, too, and do it in such a way that is conscious of the environment, and do design and work that really does improve the environment in many different ways. And we felt that this system of transportation, this very fast and electrically generated for all the trains, is basically pollution free.
So this program that you're suggesting or that you're putting forward, I guess this is going to be a question that many people are going to ask is, we'll compare it to California. I mean, hopefully you'd learn something and that the state would learn something to not make the mistakes that California has been making. And maybe we borrow more from how Europe has had success with it. How are you going to pay for this? What is your plan?
Okay. As I said before, we anticipate using this system of this corridor, new corridor. You know, let's get that straight. It's not going to use the existing rails. It's basically in line with the I-5 corridor, double tracked, exclusively electrified, no grade crossings. And this system then will act as a way in which we can both move commuters and passengers between cities, you know, commuters to their various suburban homes, but also to distant cities. And then lastly, the movement of lightweight freight between the hours of late night last servicing, let's say at 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock in the morning, or between commuter hours during the day. I can get into that more if you want, but that, you know, with that user, we're talking the big boys here, the UPSs, the Amazons, the FedExes, even Walmart. If we do this right, having transfer points for unloading goods or loading goods onto the train and zip it down along the I-5 corridor and go to other transfer points. You know, so you go to from an airport to a transfer point, and then it's distributed to smaller trucks. And we believe that this type of system, we've already done analysis on it and studies with TEMS on it, and it's been proven that there's a real possibility here that the regular taxpayer does not have to pay the bulk of the costs here. You know, if you allow me, I can go the next step on this.
Please do.
Basically, it's leasing the tracks rather than buying the tracks. Okay, so if you think in terms of real estate, you go to a bank and borrow money for developing a project and then lease that property out. What we want to do is, you know, ahead of time, have agreements on lease arrangements, or, you know, basically get memorandums of understanding on it, and then go to the bank, go to the feds, go to whomever, where the money resources are, and get them to pay for it.
I see. There is questions of, I have questions personally. How has the track record, no pun intended, been for safety? Do these kinds of, I know Amtrak has issues and some collisions or, you know, bad accidents. How has high-speed rail been over 60 years in Europe and Asia?
Well, let's start with the oldest system on Earth, and that is the Shinkansen in Japan. It's been around since the 1964 Olympics. That's what it was built for. And now they have 2,000 miles of track in Japan. Now we're talking, what is it, over 50 years, and they have not had an accident, a death related to an accident yet. And they've been very succinct about getting to their locations within seconds. So it's not only, you know, a very safe way to travel, but it's, you know, very dependable as well. Now, you might recall the accident that occurred up near DuPont when the inaugural run for Amtrak occurred between just south of Lakewood.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, that was in 2018. It had nothing to do with high-speed rail, okay? It's not a high-speed rail system in which they used $800 million of stimulus dollars that they got in 2009 to rehabilitate the existing line for Burlington Northern. Now, they were supposed to put a bypass on that that was basically a flyover from the existing track north to the existing track south to avoid that 30-mile-an-hour turn. They didn't. They didn't use any of that $800 million for that. And that's what caused the accident. They, you know, the mindset of the engineers, who was very poorly trained, was that, oh, boy, we're on a, you know, the inaugural run, we're going to top speed it, and we're going to make record time down to Portland. Unfortunately, three people died, and over 60 people were injured in that accident.
That was a tragedy, of course. I heard an interview recently with a man named Brian Kelly, CEO of the High Speed Rail Authority, speaking very highly of this project and of this program. And you had mentioned that our new administration and Pete Buttigieg, excuse me, seems to be very gung-ho and very open and excited for us to, well, catch up and to lead in high-speed rail. It's a big price ticket. I hear estimates $24 to $40 billion, but that's a big comma there. The payoffs will be huge. Correct? And it seems like the energy is starting to move that direction. Are you optimistic that this is going to be seeing some progress in the next years or so?
With the new Biden administration and our new transportation secretary, Buttigieg, I have become more optimistic than I have since starting on this. As you know, Biden has been an advocate of Amtrak for many, many years. He's ridden it almost daily as a senator from Delaware to D.C. So that's great. And with Buttigieg recently saying that not only do we want to have high-speed rail America, but we want to lead the world in it, that's great too. And here we have Peter DeFazio, who is our congressman from our state, who is head of the House of Representatives for Transportation, which is another great link or possibility of getting something done. Now, again, I want to repeat the importance of this fact, and it's different than what other systems have been thinking or doing, including California in this. I think the big mistake that they have had is that they have not made this an advantageous investment opportunity for people with money, especially major corporations that deal in transportation of goods. And the other problem that they have had down there is the system in which they are building it. Our system will be much different, similar to the Chinese who have now in the close proximity of doing 15,000 miles of tracks, lane tracks, since 2007. That's 13 years, almost 1,000 miles a year. And their method is a gantry, using a gantry system, which is building sections and then transporting them and setting them in place on top of columns. What they're doing down in California is building formwork up to where they're going to pour the concrete, and then dismantling all that formwork when they're done, and then move on to the next two columns to develop. So there's a great deal of time savings and a great deal of money saved in that type of process.
I think it would be wise to look and to copy, or at least take inspiration from, those who have been doing this for so much longer and successfully. In our last couple minutes here, just a question. Between Eugene, or you said between Portland and Everett, or correct me, that was at Wilsonville?
And yeah,
Everett.
Wilsonville.
How many stops do you think you might see in that space?
About 17. And most of those are commuter stops. There'll still be the ability to go straight from Portland to Seattle without any stops. I mean, but because there's so much capacity on this new corridor with two tracks, you will be able to bypass slower trains or trains with more stops at various train stations. There will be three tracks at least at the train stations.
So, Brad, you're coming to the end of your Tier 1 environmental impact statement. What's the latest, and how is this moving the ball forward for you?
Well, it's going real well. We've had three webinars earlier in June and May, and we will be finishing up the documentation at the first part of October with our final webinar. And we've had good response. We've had a lot of questions. And this is all gearing up for our next Tier 2, which we will be seeking a great deal of money from the infrastructure bill that's coming up soon to be approved, I hope. That infrastructure money, we hope to get a piece of it in the Northwest. I think most of it will probably go to California. And also the East Coast in regards to rail development. Now, Biden needs to get it straight in regards to the fact that it can't be Amtrak what we're in need of money for. Ray LaHood, Anthony Fox, as well as Norman Minetti, all the former transportation secretaries agree with Buttigieg that we need to be world leaders on high-speed rail. And this is our approach as well. And we will not think of ourselves as being an Amtrak.
Well, if we're supposed to be, you know, taking the lead, we've got a long way to go, and we better have a real fast train to catch up with some of the other countries that have been doing this for so long.
Yeah, let me give you a for instance here. Since 1949, $2 trillion has been spent on our highways, $7 billion has been spent on aviation and $100 million on rail passenger service, and only $8 million in 2009 and 10 has been spent on high speed rail. We've been shortchanging rail development for 50 years. Okay, so it's time that we get back on track and try to get a piece of the action this time for real high-speed rail development, because that's where a lot of the return investment can come from with the developments at the town centers and all the attractiveness of having it become part of productivity and growth in our region.
What is the website again, Brad?
CascadiaHighSpeedRail.com,
and your email is Perkins@
CascadiaHighSpeedRail.com. Yes.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time, Brad. I do wish this moves on down the track very quickly, and maybe we can check in with you again 6 months down the line and see where we're at.
Yeah. Move down the track like a bullet train.
Thank you so much for your time, Brad, and good night.
All right. Thank you much.
Times Like Now can be found wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you to the letter J, Cody Robertson, for original music. My name is Trevor. I can be reached, trevor@timeslikenow.com. Thanks for tuning in, and I look forward to speaking with you next time.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Andy Wawa looks a scream at him all night. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy Wawa, silver scream, can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is mixed media artist Bonnie Meltzer. Her show, Mending the Social Fabric, is on now at the Oregon Jewish Museum and Center for Holocaust Education in Old Town and it runs through Saturday, January 29th. Thanks very much for coming back on Art Focus, Bonnie.
My pleasure. It's always been fun to come and visit with you.
I had you on a show years ago. You talked about coal trains running through your neighborhood, Kenton.
We stopped six coal terminals from being on the Oregon and Washington coast. And I did a whole show about that. So making artwork about political issues and cultural issues and social issues is right up my street.
This show, Mending the Social Fabric, it has a very kind of post-Trump feel. Well, it says on the wall, the events of the last few years, but the physical object is a huge white parachute, and on it are multiple handkerchiefs with sayings embroidered on them, such as "Knit dreamers into citizens," and "Many colors of threads woven together create a beautiful rainbow." There are many of these, and then there are embroidery hoops.